105.9 Academy FM.
BizConnect.
Promoting and connecting businesses in Kent and around the world.
Tweet us at Kent_biz.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the BizConnect radio show with myself, Martin White, and my fabulous co-host in the studio today,
Lynette Wood.
Lynette Wood, lovely to have you with us.
Lovely to be here, Martin, on this, what is Blue Monday, apparently.
I noticed you had a blue top on. What's that all about?
Well, I'm not feeling blue today, are you?
I'm not, no. I don't know. In what sense?
So apparently today, Blue Monday, the third Monday of January, is classed as Blue Monday, and we all feel a bit miserable after the Christmas, you know, Christmas that happened.
Christmas splurge and the sort of, okay. Well, no, the sun's shining. We've got a fabulous studio full of guests, as always today. So no, I'm not feeling blue at all in that sense.
No, me not either. Nope. No,
although it was a little bit chilly again this morning.
Well, it is January.
So my toes are a little bit blue. My fingers. Tell us, who have we got in the studio today? In fact, let me turn to our studio guests and let them introduce themselves. In the middle of the studio, we have...
Yes, good afternoon. I'm Sam Graves from the Maidstone Distillery.
Sam, lovely to have you with us today. And on my left...
You have Steve Burnett from Compact and Bale.
Steve, lovely to see you as well. I know you've had a bit of an adventure getting here this afternoon.
Yes, just a little. Just a little with punctures and run flat tyres.
But you're here.
Yes.
So fabulous to have
you with
us.
Might not get home, but...
No, well, that doesn't matter. As long as we get the show in. I think what we'll do, Lynette, is we're going to play a little bit of music. And when we come back, we'll talk to Sam all about the fabulous Maidstone Distillery. So stay with us and we'll be straight back after this.
105.9 Academy FM.
BizConnect.
Promoting and connecting businesses in Kent and around the world.
Tweet us at Kent_biz.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much for joining the BizConnect radio show today. I'm delighted to say that we've got Sam Graves with us from the Maidstone Distillery. Sam, lovely to have you with us today.
Lovely to be here.
And what I'd like to do, if we can, Lynette, is talk a little bit about hospitality, what Christmas kind of trading looked like for you guys, what it looks like at the moment. Obviously, we weren't in a kind of lockdown situation this year like we were last year in Kent, but nevertheless, I think it's fair to say hospitality has borne the brunt of the recent restrictions again. So tell us, what was Christmas like for the Q Hotels Group?
I think Christmas was up and down, really, you know, a bit of a roller coaster. The rest of 2021 was the same. But I do think that there was people that if you were going to join a party as such, you know, you'd bought 10 tickets or 20 tickets, you were quite happy to go. Mm. If you were a large company that had bought 200 tickets, for example, then that's been changed. And some of those groups have been moved to March because they still do want to celebrate with their employees.
Mm-hmm. So people haven't cancelled necessarily. They've just kind of deferred Christmas by 3 months or so. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I think that in terms of January has been a bit of a flop, I'll be honest, in terms of meetings and events, but nobody is cancelling, they are just deferring. And whereas previously people would defer for 12 months, they prefer, you know, deferring for say maybe 3 or 4 months. People still want to get together, I think.
Yeah. Well, I was very lucky myself because a good friend of mine got married on New Year's Eve. And that still went ahead as planned. And there weren't any obvious kind of limitations to us enjoying ourselves on the evening. So that was great. It was lovely to be able to still do that. And the staff, I have to say, were amazing. And I'm sure you're finding that in your hotels as well.
Yeah.
It's a function like that, any kind of function, is all about the staff, really, isn't it? And
yeah,
they make it.
It's been a really, really tough year, you know, in hospitality, in staffing in general. But I think actually the people that are in it now really want to be there and they're happy to work there and they're just happy to have a job and they're happy to obviously that things go on. I'm always grateful that I've got a job still in hospitality, and which I love. You know, I love it. But I think it's great, and I do think the staff make it. And I think that New Year's Eve went ahead to Ashford International again, which was great.
Mm, fantastic. Sam, tell us about Christmas from your point of view. Tell us about gin sales and tours of the distillery. Was it a kind of a record year for you guys?
Well, yes, it was. I mean, it's our second Christmas because we're quite new. Mm. We launched in July 2020. It's absolutely fantastic. I think people really like to buy their gifts from Maidstone Distillery if they want to buy a special bottle of gin or some vouchers for a tour. So that was really good. Bumper Christmas in that respect.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Well, while we've got you, tell us a little bit about the distillery. Tell us some of the history. I mean, you've been going for 2 years. How did you get started? Why did you get started? Is that your sort of background in business? Have you and your husband always been kind of distillers of spirits? Or
short answer, no. Not at all. Nothing like it. So we incorporated the company in 2017 and 2018 is when we were really sort of starting up the business. And we thought it would take about a year to set up a distillery. Turns out it took twice as long. Mm. There's a huge amount involved. But really what inspired me and Darren was the history of distilling in Maidstone, which is actually not that well known. But when you do know it, you realise just how significant it is. It goes back 250 years. It's wow. Absolutely fascinating. Uh-huh. Darren and I have got very different backgrounds to what we do now. I was a project manager with the council, Medway Council, Kent County Council. Darren had been in the army. He'd been a captain for 10 years and then he worked in construction locally as an operations director, so a really good head honcho kind of guy. Mm. But really we wanted to do something together, husband and wife team, and Darren came across an article about distilling in Maidstone and how little known it was. Wow. And it really was that amazing history that spurred us on. It's fascinating.
Let's just pause for breath there. So you had no experience of distilling.
Yep.
You were a husband and wife team going into business for the first time together. Yep. So you really kind of set yourself a number of kind of very stretching kind of objectives there, didn't you? I think it's fair to say.
Oh goodness, and we've got three children.
And you've got three young kids.
So our youngest was about 2 months old when we started on the project. So it's been really mega. And then COVID has come along. Uh-huh. I do think in sort of 10 years time I'm going to look back and think, wow, how on earth did we do all of this? One of our proudest sort of moments really, I'd
That's
say.
Incredible. Yeah. So in terms of it taking a bit longer to happen than you thought it might do, why was that? I mean, is it just the logistics of setting up an operation like yours? I mean, what kind of took more time than you thought it was going to take?
I say there's a couple of areas, really. We've got something like 7 licences. Mm. It's incredible. And you've got to apply for them, do all the right paperwork, because it's, you know, it's a licensed activity working with alcohol.
Yeah.
But also in terms of the planning, just to physically and practically install a distillery, quite often they're on industrial estates and they've got the benefit of having lots of room and everything. We are underneath the Hazlitt Theatre in the centre of Maidstone. And it's actually very rare that a distillery is in that kind of location. Mm. It's a listed building. There's a lot of health and safety elements to it.
Is that because you wanted to be very much at the heart of the community within Maidstone because of the history around, you know, gin making and everything else? You felt you really needed to be in the centre?
Absolutely. Mm. So we are a stone's throw, literally, from the first two Maidstone distilleries that go back to 1785. We're literally a short walk from where they were located. So there's a real authenticity there.
Wow.
But we wanted to be part of the sort of interesting scene of Maidstone, which I think is really getting interesting and rejuvenated and everything. Part of a night out in Maidstone.
Right.
Come to us, have a tour,
then
go for a lovely meal at one of the lovely restaurants.
What a great idea.
Yeah, part of it.
I've never had the pleasure of a night out in Maidstone.
No.
Have you ever done that?
I think maybe once I have, yeah.
I think I went for a curry once, but...
Are you from Maidstone? Is that why?
Darren is.
Right.
I was from Tenterden originally. We live just down the road in Bearstead. Darren is born and bred Maidstone,
brilliant.
So he's very proud.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a story.
I love that. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah,
I mean, we've been talking to Sam all morning. I didn't realise she was a bit of a nutter in terms of the fact that she tried to set that up. And obviously, you know, with three children, etc.
No.
She's obviously had a busy couple of years.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Absolutely.
And in terms of the art of kind of, you know... gin making, did you have to go on a course? I mean, how does that work? You hadn't done it before. I mean, had you made some at home, sort of Prohibition era kind of, like in the back of a garden shed with nobody else knowing?
Moonshine.
So Darren did some distilling at home, nowhere near the scale to what he does it today, but he had an insight already. He'd done it for many years,
okay.
And real spirit lover. I love gin, he loves gin, but also whiskey, real whiskey man.
Yeah.
And he did do a number of courses where you sort of find out a lot more about the art of distilling, and it is really fascinating.
Yeah,
and you find out about that on our tour, like how do you actually make gin, and it is really interesting.
Yes, it is. Yeah, fabulous.
Amazing.
So in terms of you know, the actual products that you make and sell. Just tell us a little bit about those, because you've got obviously got a range of products. So tell us, what are they?
What are they? So our flagship spirit is our George Bishop London Dry Gin. Ooh. It's a 43% gin. It's Kent Spirit of the Year 2021, which we're very proud of. Our first spirit, and it's a lovely, kind of like a modern take on the sort of classic London dry gin category. So it's juniper forward, but it's quite exotic with citrus. There's some spice there, a little bit of aniseed. It's absolutely lovely as a gin and tonic or a martini, Negroni. Gorgeous.
I'm very, very sorry to say, Lynette, that Sam didn't actually bring any samples with her, did she, this afternoon?
Well, you know what? You've got to go now, haven't
we're
we?
We're going to have to book ourselves onto a tour.
But how can you have a Blue Monday talking about gin that sounds like that?
Absolutely. Turn it around, guys. It's not blue.
And then you have another product, which is I guess has a sort of slightly sort of sustainability kind of theme to it and story behind it. So tell us about that, Ranscombe.
Yes, our Ranscombe Wild Gin, which we're hoping might be up for the running of Kent Spirit of the Year this year, if anyone wants to vote.
Is that the Taste of Kent Awards, or is that something else?
That's the Taste of Kent Awards. Yeah. So Ranscombe Wild Gin, we forage for 5 of the 18 botanicals that make that gin at Ranscombe Farm near Cuxton. And we also, that reserve, that nature reserve that we forage at, is owned by a charity called Plant Life. They are a wild plant conservation charity, and we give them a donation for every bottle that we sell, and they helped us make the recipe. It was a lovely sort of partnership project. And sustainability is really important to us as a business, definitely. We have been shortlisted for a KEBA, Kent Business Award, for sustainability, and also shortlisted for sustainability with the Gin Guide last year. Yeah, it's been an important factor of our business since day one.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Good. Well, I think what we'll do is we'll play a little bit of music, and when we come back, we'll talk about your final product in the portfolio as well, which I think is a toffee liqueur.
Yes.
So a slight kind of aside from gin, but we'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about the art of gin making perhaps in a little bit more detail, because I know there's a lot more to it than just, you know, distilling a spirit, as it were. It's all in the botanicals and the juniper berries, obviously. So we'll talk more about that when we come back, but for now we're just going to play a little bit of music, but do join us after this.
Academy FM Folkestone.
Biz Connect.
The show that promotes and connects businesses.
Welcome back, everybody. We've got Sam Graves with us in the Biz Connect studio today, talking all about the Maidstone Distillery. And I think we're going to explore, Sam, if we can now, you know, some of the kind of the history behind gin, really, and its kind of resurgence in popularity. You know, we were talking sort of off air about gin becoming one of those drinks that everybody kind of indulges in today. So where do you think that's kind of come from? What do you think has kind of led to the rise in popularity of gin drinking?
Yeah, I find it really interesting, because when I meet people at the distillery, they say, oh, my nan used to just drink a Gordon's and tonic, never really fancied a gin. It is the biggest spirits category in the world, gin.
Wow.
Always has been, or is now?
Not always,
right,
but is now. And it's growing year on year. They thought it would be a boom and it would sort of tail off and something might replace it, maybe something like rum, but it hasn't happened. And I personally think a big part of the popularity is just how versatile it is. So many different flavours of gins, gin liqueurs, different kinds of cocktails that you can make with gin. And so everyone finds the kind of flavour that they love. And so I think that's really led to its popularity.
I've always been a gin drinker, and I'll be honest, I've been a Gordon's gin drinker back in the day. But I like my gin to taste like gin, which everyone says it's really boring. But you know, like, I don't like the flavoured ones or the fruity ones. I just like them to taste like good old
dry gin.
And I think that also now everyone says I don't like gin. And I think, well, that's because you probably did have it with a tonic. So is it the tonic that you don't like rather than the gin that you don't?
Yeah, possibly.
There are businesses out there now, of course, marketing themselves on the fact that, you know, a gin and tonic is 90%, you know, mixer and 10%, you know, spirit. And so you need to know the kind of the heritage of your mixer, if you like, that you're drinking with your gin. So there's a whole kind of spin-off industry that's been kind of developed on the back of that popularity,
absolutely.
I guess.
Absolutely.
Poor old Schweppes, you know, they were the only one, weren't
well,
they?
Well, they
around?
Used to be, yeah, but now...
I know, yeah. This is it. So.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because vodka tried to go the same way, didn't they? I think Absolut, you know, Swedish company, were one of the first to sort of experiment with blueberries and... or blackcurrants, rather, which is the one I used to drink. But they did a lemon one as well. And but vodka doesn't seem to sort of have that sort of popularity that gin does.
No, I don't think so.
No. Gin's classy.
It is classy.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
It is classy. Mm. It looks lovely in your glass when you've got all the garnish and people sort of feel very fancy with these lovely big Ballon
My
glasses.
My good lady drinks a rhubarb gin.
Oh, that is delicious. Nice. Yeah.
If I'm honest, I think it's because it's one of your five a day. You know, if you put the strawberries in there and the berries in there and that type of thing, I think that's what it is.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. That's interesting in itself, though. You know, it's classy. You know, Steve was saying it's classy, but you know, gin sort of in terms of popularity in Victorian times wasn't a sort of a classy drink per se, was it? It was a drink for the masses.
Oh yes,
that you would sort of drink neat. I think you know you wouldn't put a mixer in it, would you? You would just
widow's
sort
ruin,
of...
wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was mother's ruin. Absolutely. Mm. So yeah, I told you I would buff up on my dates before I came here. About the history of gin.
Brilliant.
So we do cover this at length on our tour, and it is genuinely fascinating and hilarious. Yeah. Because when did gin come over and become a big thing over here? It was 1668 with William of Orange, who was a Dutch prince who married his cousin and overthrew King James to become King of England. And being Dutch, his drink was Genever, which was the kind of pre-bearer to gin as we know it today. And he abolished all the taxes on gin making in the hope that his sort of new populace would drink gin and raise the taxes on French brandy. And so people would stop drinking the French brandy. And of course, they started drinking gin.
As a medicinal drink, I believe.
I think
originally.
So. But to be honest, just a drink like you would drink water, genuinely. So in the early 18th century was the gin craze. One in three houses were making gin. So if you try and imagine that today, one of your neighbours would be making gin if you weren't.
Wow.
Households were making it. And that's where you get sort of bathtub gin from. Yeah. They weren't bathing in their bathtub. They were using it to make gin.
Yeah.
And it was, it was hugely popular.
Amazing.
But actually, there was some really negative side effects to that. It was the only time in history that the death rate exceeded the birth rate because people were so inebriated. It affected sort of people conceiving and having babies and everything like that. Children were drinking and making them very ill. People were dying early. And then by 1729, they actually brought in the first Gin Act because some campaigners realised it was really affecting society and it was very, very bad. So they started to make it that you can't make it in your house anymore. You have to have a licence to make gin. That's fascinating. Really interesting time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about, you know, the kind of the core ingredients of gin, because I think this is the key to gin, isn't it, in many ways? You know, you start with a sort of a flavourless kind of base spirit, but then you add, obviously, juniper berries are the core ingredient. But then it's all about the botanicals that you kind of incorporate in there as well in the distillation process. So,
absolutely.
And I guess that's a sort of closely guarded secret, is it, in terms of what goes into your gin?
Indeed. Mm. Yeah, it took us a whole year to make our recipes. A lot of trial and error.
That was a tough day,
I'm sure it was. awful job. But yeah, it's all about the botanicals and in what quantities.
But that could be anything from a sort of a wild flower or plant through to, I don't know, orange or citrus or
cinnamon. Lots of cinnamon. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so gin would have core ingredients, so citrus, coriander, juniper. And then you would add on top of that, you know, what kind of gin are you trying to make? Is it spicy, nutty, woody, fruity, you know, citrusy? Yeah. And it's just so versatile, which is why it's so popular.
So, Lynette, your preferred flavour is just sort of, it's none of that. You just like it straight up.
I just like clear gin, you know, that obviously is trying to stick to the normal type of gin. I just like my alcohol to taste like alcohol. And I know that makes me sound like an alcoholic, and I'm not. But, you know, like, I don't want it to be a sweet drink or taste like juice. I just want it to be a nice gin.
Yeah. You would like a London dry gin.
Yes.
That's the sort of thing you like. And that's juniper forward. It's the classic gin.
I'd like the George
style,
one that you've got.
Bishop.
That's my one that I think I'd like.
It is delicious. Lovely, just with a tonic.
Mm.
Yeah. Really good.
I definitely need to come on one of your tours because there's clearly a whole world of gin that I've yet to experience. I tend to go what other people go for. So if I'm out with somebody and they order a gin and they ask for a particular gin, I say, OK, I'll have one of those. And I remember at a party I went to recently, somebody ordered a Dockers gin.
Dockyard,
them,
I think. Was it not a Dockyard one?
No, I think it was just called Dockers. Mm. And that seemed very, very nice. But I've no idea what type of gin, if that was a London Dry gin or, you know, what particular kind of flavours they were trying to kind of promote within that. So I clearly need to kind of do some sampling, I think, yes, and get definitely. Myself along to the distillery.
Yeah, well, we do a tutored gin tour, gin tasting, I should say, at the very end of the tour. So you get some neat samples of gin, which you'd be really brave and try neat to see if you can guess which botanicals are in there. So it's quite sensory, but you learn a lot about gin. It's great fun.
That's what we need to do, Lynette.
Yeah. Sounds like my type of place, along. This. Yeah. Can we go for a work meeting there?
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Well, maybe we could do a live show from there. From the distillery, pre-sampling, not obviously post. But talking about sweet, one thing we haven't mentioned in the Maidstone Distillery product lineup is your Sharp's Toffee Liqueur.
Yes.
So that's obviously not a gin, far from it. So tell us about why. Why did you kind of go down that route with that drink?
So absolutely, it's not a gin, because gin must contain juniper. So there's no juniper in the toffee liqueur. So we want every spirit that we make to tell a story, to have a link locally to something or someone or some place. And Sharp's Toffee Liqueur is all about the Sharp's Toffee Factory, which was based in Maidstone. And it's just another fascinating legacy. Yeah. So in 1812, I believe, Edward Sharp had the world's largest sweet factory on the banks of the River Medway in the centre of Maidstone.
Gosh.
And that's amazing in itself. Mm. That factory ended up being taken over by Tribor and Cadbury afterwards, but he was world famous for his creamy toffee. Back in the days where you'd buy it in a block and you'd have the little toffee hammer, you know, people can probably remember those. It's so much fun. I remember that as a child.
I don't, just so you know, I don't.
Yes.
Yes. I do.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were inspired by that legacy.
Oh, wow.
So we actually work with the brand holders, the people who now own the Sharps brand. Uh-huh. Got his sort of signature on the bottle and everything, and it's a toffee liqueur. It's just to be enjoyed like you would something like a Bailey's, an Irish liqueur, neat over ice.
So not quite as strong as a bottle of gin then?
No, about
20% maybe.
Yeah, 22%. So it's a slightly stronger liqueur. Mm-hmm. So you get a nice little bit of a burn, but not too much. It's overpowering.
Fantastic.
Not too sickly. It took a long time actually to get this recipe right. Mm. Yeah, but it's absolutely delicious.
What I love about you guys, I think, is everything has a story to it, doesn't it? You know, and it's all very much about sort of local heritage and local story and kind of bringing that into your brand, which I think is fantastic. And it's what people want these days, isn't it? You know, everything food and drink wise, I think, is certainly in Kent, is all about kind of locally produced and local story to it. So all credit to you on that front. Sam, we're fast running out of time. Give us a quick shout out for your website and how we can kind of, you know, book onto a distillery tour, for example, or I guess we can just order your product online as well. So how do we do that?
Yeah, so our website is themaidstonedistillery.com. We have a shop on site, so you can walk in if you're just in Maidstone doing some shopping, but then of course you can order online and have our lovely spirits posted to you. You can book the tour online. There's a live calendar which you can scroll through to find the right date and time for your group. We also do a gin making experience where people can come in and make their own bottle of gin on a mini still.
Wow.
Which is actually really fun, really well received.
Yeah,
so super. All online.
Well, build a bear, eh?
Oh, yes.
Well, we look forward to all of that, don't we, Lynette, at some point in the very near future. But for now, Sam, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Do stay with us, because when we come back after this next musical interlude, we're going to be talking to Steve and we're going to be talking about waste and rubbish and recycling and circular economy and sustainability. So I know those are all kind of core themes close to your heart as well. So do stay with us and we'll be straight back after this.
105.9 Academy FM.
Biz Connect.
Promoting and connecting businesses in Kent and around the world.
Tweet us at Kent_biz.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you so much for joining the Biz Connect radio show today for our first show after Christmas, Lynette.
Absolutely, yeah.
We've got two fabulous guests in the studio. We've just been talking with Sam Graves from the Maidstone Distillery, and now we're going to have a chat with Steve Burnett from Compact & Bale. Steve, welcome to the studio.
Hello, hello.
lovely to have you with us today.
Yeah, good to be here. Thank you.
And especially considering the fact that you had a flat tire this morning on your way here.
Yeah, a bit of drama getting here. thank goodness for run flat tires.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
Absolutely. Brilliant. But it's lovely to have you with us. Tell us, Steve, in your own words, a little bit about Compact and Bale and what you guys do.
Okay, so, well, I started Compact and Bale back in 2000, having sold balers. So a baler is a machine that squashes rubbish.
Right.
Generally segregated stream of waste that's put into a baling machine, squashed into blocks so that it can be conveniently handled, stacked, stored, loaded, transported for recycling. So if you want to put a waste stream into a shape that it can be bought from you, you need a baler.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd sold balers for somebody else, and I'd really sort of thought to myself that they sold the balers, but they didn't collect the material. And I saw an opportunity to tie the two things together. The only problems I ever had with the jobs that I was doing working for these other people wasn't the baling machines, it was getting the material collected. The unreliable companies that my boss was telling me to work with, mm-hmm. or the fact that they said, oh, we'll pay you £50 a tonne, and then after 2 months they dropped the price to £10 a tonne, and mm-hmm. my customer's ringing me up saying, what's going on, you know, mm-hmm. so I thought if I could sort that out, mm-hmm. I could probably sell half as much and earn twice as much. I did forget about working 10 times as hard. that was then. That was back in 2000. Since then, we've had a continued growth. We've steadily grown year on year. We've had a couple of years where we've slipped back a little. COVID has been a tough time. You know, a lot of companies haven't been producing waste. Lots of our clients have been shopping centres. And businesses that have, you know, hospitality businesses, people like that have just not had the customers, so they haven't had the waste. We rent a lot of our machines out, and a lot of our customers have looked to us to give them a rental holiday so that they could, you know, get through, which we have been able to do and work with people. So things have picked up, certainly. I think a business that helps people save money, particularly in today's climate where, you know, people are looking to see your sustainability, what your recycling credentials are. You know, the pressure is coming from the top and the bottom far more so.
Mm.
And when I first started, people thought I was mad.
Because in that context alone,
going into recycling,
yeah. But in that context alone, it's incredibly important, isn't it? In terms of the kind of the kind of responsibility we all have today towards the environment, towards sustainability.
Yep.
I mean, I'm astonished by the fact that we still actually export 2/3 of our plastic waste in the UK abroad for reprocessing, which I find mind-boggling.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm by no means an expert on, you know, the global plastics recycling market. We're very much a sort of a practical solutions company. So at a ground level, we will look and see what, you know, we help people draw their waste map, work out who's producing how much of what, where and why, what the right solution might be to harvest that material and direct it towards recycling.
Mm.
Every kilogram we can take out of your paid-for waste, every ton, you know, waste is generally done in tons with the kind of clients we're working with, saves them £300.
Yeah.
So if we can then earn the money with it instead.
Yeah.
But plastics, I think there's been woeful underinvestment, and also there are parts of the world where the cost of labour and the cost of space. Now, I've visited some of these countries. I've spent a lot of time in the Philippines.
Mm.
Working with a rubbish dump charity, there's people being paid $1 a day to sort plastic,
pick through it on a rubbish tip.
A whole family will get they'll get a bale that comes in that weighs half a ton or a ton or whatever that bale size is, and they take it apart and they literally separate it out into that one, and the whole family will be there. And that's waste is social security for people in the third world. You know, 40,000 scavengers lived on the rubbish dump that I visited, and 25,000 in the cemetery next door, living in the emptied tombs of the dead.
Mm.
And they literally live, eat, build their houses, everything, all their clothes, everything comes from that rubbish dump. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Literally heartbreaking. But
well, we have just passed a new act, I think, haven't we, at the end of last year, a new Environment Act, which is hopefully going to put the brakes on some of that activity. But the fact that, you know, we can't or we don't see enough of a reason to invest in that kind of infrastructure to process our own waste, you know, in the UK is totally beyond me. But going back to what you do,
yep.
Give us some kind of practical examples, because I think I saw you post the other day on LinkedIn something about somebody that had polystyrene or something, or some kind of packaging product that they were now baling up that you could, yep, kind of squash into bricks, if you like.
Yes, yeah, that would have been expanded polystyrene, yeah, which is a nightmare for anybody, really, if you're a company. So I'm thinking of a company, one of our clients with polystyrene is Konica Minolta, if I can give them a name drop, up in Basildon. So they supply business machines, you know, photocopiers, things like that.
Yep.
They come in big boxes and they're very well protected with lots of white expanded polystyrene.
Mm.
Now, if you fill a whole Arctic trailer with loose polystyrene, it weighs, well, we can compact that down to half a pallet.
Mm.
So it weighs about, you know, two or three or 400 kilos, depends on the density.
Mm.
So it's totally impractical to drive it anywhere, do anything with it.
Mm.
The waste companies don't want it. Landfills don't want it. Incinerators don't want it. You know, there's just not enough. It's all fresh air.
Mm. Mm.
So really the only way to practically deal with it is to use a briquetting press.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of types of machines we supply. By far the majority, they use a screw auger that twists the material, creates friction, causes it to melt, therefore it can be compressed, mm-hmm, in a restricted channel.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you put 40 parts in and you get one part out,
mm,
or right up to putting 100 parts in and getting one part out, depending on, mm-hmm, what machine, what model.
And can that product then be used as part, yes, of a sort of circular economy, I don't know, as an insulation material for construction?
Once it's been briquetted, mm-hmm, it's then polystyrene, it's PS, mm-hmm, instead, mm-hmm, of EPS.
Mm-hmm.
So that can go back into the manufacturing. I think they make picture frames from it, various other hard plastic products,
yeah,
you know, various things are made from polystyrene.
Yeah.
So I guess, or it can go back round and be made back into expanded polystyrene, yes, as well.
That is a good example,
just
isn't
so
it?
That's so, yeah, incredible. Yeah. I'm sitting on, like, with my mouth, mm, open going, yeah, oh my goodness.
Cardboard. I'm crazy about cardboard, mm, you know, people tell me. And I love cardboard. I'd love to meet the guy that invented cardboard,
yeah,
because it does everything you could possibly want it to do. It, mm, protects. It absorbs moisture,
mm,
it's relatively lightweight.
Mm. It can insulate?
Yes, yeah, it insulates. Mm-hmm. It then can be recycled up to 9 times.
Mm.
So if you throw a cardboard box away,
yeah,
you're throwing another 8 boxes away behind,
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Because the fibres keep going through.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderfully recycled material. And, yeah, I often wonder when I'm walking around warehouses and looking at waste sites and stuff, I just wonder how much cardboard there is in,
yeah,
the world at any given time.
Yeah,
you are quite crazy if that's what you're thinking. Yeah.
My
but I love the
it's
polystyrene.
Free money. It's all free money that, yeah, your suppliers give you around the outside of what you buy from,
yeah,
them.
Yeah.
So if we can get people looking at waste as a resource, as a,
yes,
product, as an income,
yeah,
then the practicalities of what,
yeah,
we do, really, you either need one or you don't.
Yeah.
You know, I could very quickly tell for your business if you would benefit from having a baler or not, because it's,
mm,
doing the math.
Mm.
Yeah, simple as that.
Yeah, it makes, yeah, sense, doesn't it? If you're having to package something in,
mm,
a cardboard box,
mm,
and having to send it to your clients in that box, and then actually, by whatever you're doing or how you can recycle it, you're,
mm,
making money from the fact that you're using it. It's,
mm,
a no-brainer, isn't,
mm,
it?
Yeah,
mm,
yeah, yeah. Old companies, I visit companies and they are throwing away thousands of pounds, and it's not. It's even worse than that, because they're paying their waste contractor,
mm,
a premium transport rate to drive a lorry, which he charges them by the kilogram for their goods, their waste. He then takes ownership of their waste when it gets back to his site, which he sorts out and he bales it and sells it.
Mm.
So it adds insult to injury, almost.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that waste contractors don't have a place in,
no,
the system,
mm,
but you're better.
Well, yes.
Perhaps slightly more ethical.
I try,
yeah,
to help people save money,
yeah,
and improve their operations, slim things down. Why handle it too many times? If you can put it from the minute it becomes waste, you put it in a baler.
Mm.
Every time you touch it afterwards, it's in an economical to handle block, usually a half-ton bale, which then you stack up 15 of those, 30 of those, or 60 of those, and we come along and buy it from you.
Brilliant.
Rather than paying for it.
I think what we'll do now, it's a good place to sort of play a bit more music. When we come back, I think we'll talk more about sustainability and perhaps the future of your industry, Steve, as well, in that context, if we can. But for now, we're going to play a little bit of music, and we'll be straight back after this.
105.9 Academy FM.
Biz Connect.
Promoting and connecting businesses in Kent and around the world.
Tweet us at Kent_biz.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much for staying with the Biz Connect radio show today. This is the final part of the show. I'm delighted to say we're talking to Steve Burnett from Compact and Bale, all about rubbish and solutions to your rubbish problem in your business. Steve, before the break, we were talking about the wide range of sort of applications for baling machines, from polystyrene to cardboard, plastics, etc.
Yep.
But tell us, what's the process that the business needs to go to? At what point as a business do I decide, you know what, I might need to give Steve a ring because we are producing so much of this particular type of waste, it might be in my interest to hire a baling machine and then sell that product back to Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I think despite, you know, there's a great awareness of waste and recycling, a lot of companies are sort of taking the standard advice, if you like, the normal route for waste, which is a skip and journey based solution, which is promoted by just about every waste contractor. Some waste contractors are very good and will, you know, work with companies to install balers and compactors. But others will keep enjoying the fact that you've got 20 1100 litre wheelie bins outside being emptied three times a week, and they won't tell you about anything else because it's quite profitable for them. So, you know, I think if you've got a waste bill that is more than £100 a week, I would generally say that's definitely somewhere where we can start. If when you look outside you see too many skips, you've got too much waste, you know, you've got rubbish, you've got people dealing with it. You know, one of the big things at the moment we're seeing a big increase in is automation, self-loading baling systems, or taking the manual handling out of it. Staff are unreliable. They're not unreliable. Many staff are very reliable. But getting the right staff and getting them to do what is actually quite a mundane, back-breaking job, you know, handling waste, when they could be doing something far more productive.
Skips are a good example, aren't they? Because, you know, skips are actually incredibly wasteful, aren't they? Because you can never load a skip up to its kind of optimum capacity, can you?
They hide a multitude of evils, we say.
It gets thrown in and it's all higgledy-piggledy, and there's huge air kind of gaps between the waste.
Out of sight, out of mind. We often, when we get into sites, we'll, you know, I'll climb up and I have a look and I take pictures and video and I don't go in because it's not safe to go in. But I do a bit of bin diving, and you say to people, well, you know, did you know you've got 26 pallets in there and a couple of plastic things, and one of those, oh, they're not supposed to put that in there. But no one's checking because people do what's easiest. Human nature, you come out, you've finished your shift, you've got three pieces of rubbish, you've got one big skip there that takes everything, or maybe you're supposed to walk down there and then walk down there. What are you going to do? You've already stayed 15 minutes late, the missus has been texting you know. or the husband, sorry, but you know, you're just going to do what's easiest, chuck it in there, you know. And if no one actually pulls you up on it, no one cares.
And once something else is on top of it, no one else can see what's underneath
anyway. Yeah, that's it.
We've got to sort of fundamentally change our attitude towards, I'm not going to call it rubbish, I'm going to call it our waste product, haven't we?
It's a resource. That's what we try to do, is to change the way our clients look at waste. It's sort of simple sense, often packaging waste is free money that your suppliers put around the outside of the goods you buy from them. And if you can do the right thing first time, I say to people, you know, you have a moment when that goes from being the box or the container or the plastic or whatever it is, you empty it, you do whatever, and in that moment, freeze frame, it becomes waste. So what's the best thing to do then? Because if you can do the right thing first time, everything that follows that becomes more cost effective and efficient. You know, you don't want to throw that cardboard box on the floor and then, when you've got 20 cardboard boxes on the floor, go and get a cage, come back, take each cardboard box, put it in the cage, then take the cage out to the baler, leave it in a row of cages, then somebody else unloads all of those cages box by box by box and puts it into a baler or a skip or whatever. If you could put it into a cart with all the other cardboard boxes and then walk up to a baler, push that cart in, press the start button and let the machine do the work, then you've saved all that labour. And operatives, generally, they're earning their employers 4 to 6 times their salary cost when they're working on productive work, forward-facing work, the business of that company. If they're working on waste, it's rear-facing work. They're you know, barely covering their cost, if that. So you're not making any profit with them.
And I can see the value that Steve adds. The beauty of what he does, I think, is he can come into your business and he can break it down into each of those kind of processes and components.
Divide to multiply. That's the business principle, is to divide to multiply. Break it into the little steps. Yes. You don't just say compact and bale, recycle. Mm-hmm. You say compact and bale, you know, and we help you write your waste system. Yeah. So we draw your waste map.
Yeah.
This might be metaphorically speaking, you know, not quite literally. Yeah. I'm not going to get a pen and a marker paper, you know, pen and paper and a big marker out. Yeah. But,
well, that's what I want, Pete.
I can if you want. I've always got a pad with me and I'm always drawing, actually.
Well, something as simple as, you know, did you realise that Dave in the warehouse actually spends 3 hours a day walking cardboard from A to B, you know, to stick in a skip?
And
you know, I mean, must be a real eye-opener for many.
He has to keep going indoors and outdoors, so he has to open a door. So warm air, cold air, bad weather, good weather, whatever. Does he have a crafty fag behind the bin, you know, that kind of thing. what you want is for Dave to be doing his job where he makes you a profit.
Yeah.
Where, you know, that's what he's there for. Yeah. So if we can help you deal with waste efficiently and then follow that through so that waste is now no longer waste, it's a resource. Cardboard can be sold currently. You know,
that's what I'm like. I think it's because we talk about waste as in waste. So in our head, waste is waste, and that's where the end of it is, right? So you've got it through your business, you've got to the waste, you've thrown it out, and we've had to pay whatever it is to take it away, and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
But to think that you could actually earn revenue,
it's a revenue
from
stream.
Your waste,
which not mixed
it's
up
like
to start with.
Mad.
If you take cardboard, plastic, paper, wood, tins, bottles, whatever, you put it all in a skip together, it's waste.
Yeah.
But if you took it all out and put it into piles, it's cardboard, plastic, paper. You know, so it is a case of finding what you've got that you've got enough of to deal with through a recycling solution if you need a baler. And I really do not sell or hire balers to people that don't need them.
Yeah.
Because if I go back after 3 months, they're like, what did you do?
Yeah.
I've got 9,000 followers on social media that rely on me. Yeah. I've got a reputation. I don't want to sell you what you don't need. I want to come back after 3 months and I say, I'm going to take it away and have you throw me off site, because no way. It's the best thing we've ever
had. Don't you take my baler.
Yeah, that's it.
We are running out of time. On that basis, you know, what's the best way for people to get in touch, to kind of to book some of your time for you to come in and take a look at our process, take a look at our waste products and see if there is an opportunity there to make more
of
it?
I mean, via our website is probably you know, compactandbale.com. You can search for us. The website does technically have hyphens in because someone told me that was a good idea in the year 2000 and it's just stayed that way. But if you just search for Compact and Bale on Google, you'll find us. We've got online chat.
You can do an
inquiry form. Okay. You can call the office. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm the original Baler Man, or hashtag Super Baler Man. Please don't.
In a Super Baler suit, I noticed.
How did that start?
Fantastic.
But we're playing with it now. So
good.
Yeah, we're easily found.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Steve. And also, Sam, thank you for joining us today from the Maidstone Distillery. It's been a fascinating discussion. Lynette, thank you as well for co-hosting today. Lovely to see you.
Absolute ball. I was buzzing before I came in, and now I'm like even more. It's just amazing.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
It's been lovely.
Fantastic. We do need to end the show, sadly, but we will be back in 2 weeks' time on the 31st of January at 2 o'clock, 2 to 3, with another couple of fabulous guests. But until then, it's goodbye from me and goodbye from everybody else.
So goodbye from us.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Bye for now.